Welcome to the Negotiations Ninja podcast, where we develop and deliver the most engaging negotiation content and training in the world. We host negotiation experts, business people, and entrepreneurs, and discuss what works, what doesn't work, and how we can improve our negotiation skills. What's going on, everyone? You got Mark here from the Negotiations Ninja podcast. This is a throwback Thursday to an interview that I did with my friend, Mr. Cal Krusty, on his experiences negotiating with terrorists. And I don't think that there is many people in the world today that have the depth of experience that this man has when it comes to negotiation. I truly respect and admire him and the work that he's done. And I think you're going to get a lot out of this episode. Highly encourage you to share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it. Have a fantastic day. Cal, good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Mark. How are you?
I am splendid, my friend. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm pumped to have this discussion. For the listeners, just so that you know, Cal and I have been talking about getting him back on and talking about, we've been going through this series of the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to negotiations, and Cal has certainly seen his fair share of all of those things. Before we get into it, Cal, maybe you could share with the listeners a bit about yourself and what you do.
Thanks very much, Mark. Real quickly, just a quick overview of my background relative to negotiations. 34 years with the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, our federal police agency, in hostage negotiations, but also in addition to hostage negotiations, community conflict negotiations, which include protest situations. Also, for about 25 years, in and out of international kidnapping situations, where the last 6 or 7 years of my career before I retired 2 years ago was team leader of our national kidnapping negotiations, which were focused primarily on terrorist-related incidents, and several peacekeeping tours at the height of the war in the former Yugoslavia, where I was very involved, first exposed 25 years ago to the world of negotiations in the area of prisoners of war negotiations, dead body exchanges, and kidnapping negotiations. My training included, as most Canadian hostage negotiators, at the Canadian Police College. Then I was fortunate enough to take and complete the FBI hostage course, and then later the Scotland Yard course, as well as continued my education at the university level. And in 2005 to 2010, did my master's of law at Osgoode Law School and studied the field of ADR, specializing in negotiations and conflict management. That's kind of my background. Then currently working with Interventus Global since 2018, and that's a group of other hostage negotiators, some of them formerly from the FBI, some of them from the UN, and some of them from Israel.
Amazing. Incredible history and such a lot of experience. And Cal, I guess my first question for you, let's just dive in. You've had your fair share of negotiations, and some of them haven't worked out as well as you would have liked. What's one of the negotiations that you've had that didn't go according to plan that was probably the worst negotiation you've ever been in?
Okay. And feel free to clarify any questions throughout, because I think, as we mentioned that before in the prelim, just out of respect for the circumstances and the people that were involved, I'll be a little cryptic, but I hope to put enough details so that it's understandable for your listeners. It was a foreign international kidnapping case involving a well-known violent terrorist group. The negotiations went on for approximately a year. At the outset, as you know, normal standard practice, a significant amount of time, effort, and energy and focus on doing our analysis, not only at the front end, but throughout any kind of negotiation process, including these type of negotiations. And in this particular case, our research was congruent with what the other party was alluding to, and I find saying other party maybe too nice, what the terrorist group was articulating. And that was their interest, their demands. They wanted a large ransom payment. And that was consistent with comprehensive research with others that had been involved in negotiating with this group. However, unfortunately, during the course of the negotiation process, as I alluded to, the several hostages that we had were executed during the actual negotiation process. And I guess I'll probably spend more than 2/3 of my time talking about this one versus the one that went well. only because I truly believe, you know, wisdom comes from the failures and the challenges that we encounter. And so I just kind of highlight that. I'll probably try to, this one will take a little longer than the other one to explain.
And that's fantastic background. Why do you think, like, I mean, you went into it expecting, and based on your research, you guys were expecting a ransom payment. And so as a result, you were basically trading money for people, but then something happened that caused them to execute the hostages. What happened?
Well, I'll just insert in there just the other aspect. What often surfaces in these negotiation processes, the obvious one is the ransom, and the other one that comes up prominently as an interest often, and you see it with organizations like ISIS and historically Al-Qaeda and other type of terrorist negotiations, is obviously the political motive, where these groups and terrorist organizations in the negotiation process really aren't interested that much in the money. Sometimes they are, sometimes they're not. Sometimes it's a bit of a blend, but it's the political interest. So sometimes they commit horrific acts to make a political statement to the world to bring attention to their cause. So to go to what were some of the lessons that were learned out of this particular one, I think in terms of a reflective analysis, and of course, it's always 2020 post these events, but when I reflect on things that could have been different, and I'm not sure they would have any different outcome, but at least we probably would have done a better job managing expectations and maybe could have looked at some other things. I'm not too sure, you know, it would require too much in-depth analysis. But probably the number one lesson, and I introduced the term locus of control to your listeners. A locus of control is a psychological state of assessing what's in your control through your own actions versus what is not in your control due to external actions. And I think probably within the team and within the parties that we were working within, in terms of organizations and government agencies and that, there probably wasn't enough awareness, discussions. And when, you know, when you talk about self-awareness as a negotiation, maybe not enough team awareness and organizational awareness as to what really our locus of control was. I think that we probably, like from looking at first from an analytical perspective, our ability to analyze the situation was probably not accurately assessed, because I think we overestimated what our locus of control was as it related to the analysis, and that we really probably didn't have an accurate assessment of what our analytical capabilities were. There was a lot of distance geographically between us and the people we were negotiating with, which made it very difficult. You know, we didn't have face-to-face negotiations with them. Sometimes we do. Sometimes we do it through third parties that allow us to get a better sense as to who the other parties are, whether they're being genuine, whether there's other interests there, you know, because all we were doing was phone calls, which made the conversations very difficult to kind of assess things. We weren't picking up the body language. The phone reception wasn't good, and they were short, intermittent, quick discussions versus, you know, when you're sitting down at a negotiating table and, you know, having that small talk or talking about other issues, you're still kind of getting a sense as to the intent, the genuineness of the other party. And in this particular case, we just didn't have our opportunity, and visibility on the other party was rather limited. So it was very hard to make those proper assessments and do our diagnostic assessments as to what are their interests versus, like, what are their stated interests versus what are their unstated interests. And as you are familiar, and most of your listeners are, when you're in a conflict situation, like this is obviously a conflict situation, some interests are disclosed, other ones are not disclosed. And sometimes the real interests aren't not disclosed. And I think in this particular one, I think perhaps we overestimated our ability to properly assess it. And we went based on, you know, what our visibility was, what their interest was. And that was, we were focused on it being a business oriented negotiation process for money. And we didn't anticipate, and we didn't see, and we didn't identify that there was probably other interest within the negotiation process, which was the political motivation, or that there was dual purposes of the negotiation process from the outset. We missed that. And I think it just goes to our locus of control. I think we assessed we had more capability than we did at the outset. That would be number two in terms of that. And it's interconnected with locus of control, is the issue of restraints versus constraint or restraints versus constraints on us was really what was our ability as a negotiating team to do it. And I would imagine this applies to a lot of business negotiations as well, and government negotiations as well, obviously, in this particular case, is that although we had a degree of latitude, we also had some restraints and constraints on us in terms of, you know, making substantive concessions to terrorist organizations, which is, you know, a government policy thing. So we were constrained at times by that, you know, our ability to travel into different areas to meet people, you know, due to safety, security issues were on it. And I think when we reflectively look at what were the restraints, what were the constraints on it, what was the locus of control that we had in our negotiation process, right at the very outset, I think we probably underestimated how difficult this case would be from the very outset. And then added to that was the trust factor. And I think another area, because we were involved in doing negotiations with partners that were involved in the negotiation process. And I think in this particular one, this is one where I look in the mirror retrospectively and I go, yeah, I missed this one. Probably could have, should have done something a little different in here. Would it have any difference in the outcome? I think probably not, but it definitely would in other future cases, I think. And I kind of beat myself up for this one a little bit because it was a lesson I learned a long time ago about trust and trusting people, groups, and organizations. And that is that when the waters are calm and things are going good, it's easy to trust people. Their behavior is always on the positive side, congruent often with their words. But when you hit bumpy waters and rough waters, in any type of life situation, and the stress and the pressure and the stakes get higher, that's when people truly get tested in terms of, you know, who they are, what their principles are, what the reliability of the people are going to be, and how they're going to behave under genuine circumstances. It's always in my life, particularly coming from war zones, the people that you think are really solid in your day-to-day activity, say back in Canada or in the United States versus those that are in those situations in a war zone, there's a big difference, and people are often surprised, and I've always been surprised that the true character of people come out in the pressure of who you think may be super solid and trustworthy in this situation when the waters are calm are not the same people that can have that same resilience and strength and adherence to principles when the pressure's on. And I think in this particular case, when the pressure really got on and the deadlines were coming, the threats were coming from the group, there was a few cracks with our partner agencies. And, you know, I think that contributed to possibly the outcome and something that probably I should have prepared for and one could prepare for in advance, knowing that, you know, some negotiations get bumpy. So just be aware of that and look at ways to try to mitigate that or at least have an awareness for that from a risk perspective. So those are some of the things that I learned from that particular case.
Brilliant. And I love what you said, like right at the beginning, you know, hindsight's always 20/20. And so as we look into this, I want the listeners to recognize that Cal is being a lot more open than he has to and very vulnerable right now about what happened, what could have been done differently. And there are a lot of negotiation trainers in the world today that would tell you, just say these three things or move this way and that will result in XYZ action. And it's just not true. So there's a few things that I want to make sure that the listeners understand. There are things that sometimes come up in negotiations, whether it's wartime negotiations or conflict situations or business negotiations that are completely outside of your locus of control, right? They're outside of your control. We often talk about, you know, control the controllables. Sometimes you cannot control something. Sometimes things happen that are completely out of your control. And we can only look backwards and reflect back as to, you know, what we could have done maybe differently to apply it to the next negotiation to change. And that's why we always talk about why negotiation debriefs are so important, because there are things that happen in the heat of the moment that would just take us by surprise and we didn't plan for it or we didn't see it coming. And this is a fantastic example. And he's brought up three interesting points. One thing that I really want to talk about is where you said there were cracks under pressure from some of the other people or some of the other teams. Difficult to know going into that, because especially if you've never worked with those teams, you would have a difficult time understanding how they would perform under pressure. How could we, knowing that there are going to be teams that we're going to be negotiating with that might not necessarily have the same level of experience or might crack under pressure, we just don't know. How do we try and better assess that going into those kinds of situations, Cal?
Well, I think it's super difficult to assess. And that's been my life experience, you know, and it came up years ago, over 30 years ago, when I was working a robbery section and we were dealing with super high risk operations where guys going into a jewelry store or a bank armed with guns, and then the guys on the outside, you know, us doing the surveillance and things going completely sideways, completely bad, people injured, including ourselves, police officers hospitalized, shots fired. And I never saw it coming in terms of how people were going to react. It's not until you're in there. And I think in fairness, even to the people that are the ones that crack, I don't even think they know until they get into those situations themselves. So, you know, human behavior is super complex. I think, you know, in terms of preparing and trying to mitigate it, what I would say is having open, frank conversations about it within the team to bring that. You and I have talked, you know, several times, and it's one of my go-to comments and thought processes that I share in any of the training that I do with executives now, is that huge importance of humility that's brought in and becomes, in my situation, my experience with my last negotiating team that, you know, I was so proud to work with on these terrorist negotiations. That's one thing that we instilled as a pillar of our team was humility, humility, humility. And I think just talking openly about it, and anybody that like pop their head up and say, oh, no, this isn't going to happen, we would usually kind of pop them in the nose and go, as if you know, yeah, like we were pretty harsh on each other to keep that humility in check. The second thing in terms of doing that, in terms of mitigating it, I think is having those open discussions, you know, within your group, within your team and those that you're working with, and having that frank conversation as if we do this stuff in terms of anticipation. And if there are cracks, what is the fallback options that we're going to have? And it's those things that, you know, particularly in this, and we probably, like, we go to the nth degree. We, in these situations of these type of negotiations, we spend, say, theoretically, and I'm just using this as an example, we may have 2 15-minute conversations, actual negotiation conversations with the parties every week. I'm just thinking of another case that we had, but we would spend, say, if it's a total of 30 minutes a week negotiating over a period of a year and doing it every week for 30 minutes, but we would what if that, i.e. do the strategic fallback options and what if this happened, what if this happened? Probably if we did 30 minutes a week, we would probably do 30 hours a week, the what ifs. So that's how much we would brainstorm. Yeah. I'm not saying that's manageable in the corporate sector, but when we were dealing with these very high risk situations, that's how much time we looked at, you know, what if this happened? What if this happened? And so I just think, you know, it just comes to strategizing and planning. That's how much we did in these high risk situations. And it just kind of reemphasizes the importance of the planning in the negotiation process. So those would be kind of my two suggestions to mitigate that break, crack, as you alluded to.
Yeah, I think this is always the difficult part of any kind of negotiation. And this is the thing that I don't know that, I mean, and as a negotiation trainer, this is like hard for me to say, but this is the thing that I don't think you can train for except through volume. You can learn all the theory, do all of the analysis, do all the planning, but you're never going to understand where your own cracks are, where your own inadequacies might exist, or where your team's inadequacies might exist until you actually go through it. I think it's hard for people to come to terms with that. I mean, yes, we can pre-plan it. We can do pre-mortems. We can go through all of these kinds of situations and scenarios and try and plan for it as best we can. And that's super important. I'm not trying to minimize that in any kind of way. But the only way that you really, really know for sure is once you've been in it.
Yeah. And just to kind of round off, you know, this example and the failures, and I share this with your listeners, Mark. Another important concept as it relates to these failures and learning in this profession is the risk and the danger of attribution theory implications. And attribution theory is psychological theory based on animal instinct, survival mechanisms that we always defer to blaming an entity or a person. And it comes from that animal instinct of survival, right? So when animals were in their environment, and they saw another animal or threat, they automatically blamed or saw it in a negative way as a threat. And that still kind of exists in our day-to-day thinking. And it applies to these failures where when something goes wrong or there's a problem or whatever, we look at blaming the person or a person in a case rather than looking at the larger context of that locus of control that we yes. talked about, what our restraints and constraints were. You know, the tough thing that in this particular one was the attribution theory kicked in, you know, and hear whispers and rumors, and I say it and my voice is quivering a little bit here, but the guys on our team that did this, like we tried 100%. I mean, it's been a number of years, haunts me still today, and I still do my retrospective analysis. Could we done? Should we done? And even when I meet some of the guys from the team for dinner, and I did it just a week ago, we still talk about could have, should have, you know, what could we have done? But there's a real danger, I think, in terms of managers, colleagues, associates, blaming people for failures in negotiation without looking at the bigger context of the situation. And because sometimes it's just not in our capabilities to be successful in that negotiation. And, you know, I talked about on the other podcast, structures and that being important. And in the negotiation process, and it goes back to your point you made about, you know, others saying, hey, here's this magic bullet, say A, B, C, D, and everything is going to be okay. And you and I have talked about this before where I find that's really setting people up for failure. And I use that metaphor or example that I see negotiators as an actor in a movie. They are important. What they say and do is important. What their performance is important. But so is the director. So is the screenwriter. So is the people doing the props in the movie set. Yes. So is the producer. So is the executive producer. And there's a lot more to that. And then, you know, translating that to the business executive, so is the C-suite, so is the CFO, so are all these other people in terms of what have they given in terms of training or what is their restraints and constraints? What's their locus of control just in terms of the context of it? And I think that's super important. And that's something I've learned through this particular case because I've had to have those conversations with my teammates where we failed to make sure that they understood it's not, you know, although we played a role in it, and we accept, you know, a degree of responsibility for the outcome. It's not all our responsibility in terms of how these things play out sometimes.
Totally agree with you. And I think one thing that we need to be careful to do, and I know that this is something that is time consuming. And so as a result in, you know, time constrained environments, it's very hard to do after and before, particularly after every negotiation, even if the negotiation is successful. I don't think we do a good enough job of debriefing to understand not only what was within our control, but also what was outside of our control. Annie Duke talks about this a lot in her fantastic book, Thinking in Bets, where she talks about probabilistic thinking. And she speaks to a large extent about the power of luck inside of probability, because you're dealing with so many unknowns in negotiation, much like in poker, which is her background, right? So her background's all poker, and she talks about how there's so many things in poker that are outside of your control and that are unknown in that environment. And you've got to be able to plan for, or at least try and plan for those events. But as much as you might try, there are going to be some things that are totally outside of your control that you just cannot account for. And so when the game is done, or in our case, when the negotiation is done, we've got to determine, even if the negotiation went in our favor, why it went in our favor. Because there may be, to a certain extent, that it went in our favor, but it was pure luck that it went in our favor. And a lot of people think about, you know, the things that went wrong and not necessarily the things that went well. And so we try and run that same routine again and get a different result that maybe was bad. And then we're like, we're confused. And we go, okay, well, I don't know why it went bad. Well, it's because we haven't done a good enough job of debriefing to understand whether or not what actually happened was pure luck.
Mark, I can agree with you more in this particular case. And when I talk about what went well in another case, we'll talk about that. But in this particular case, I think that's what happened to us. We had some bad luck. And that was unknown to us. There was a shift in leadership within the terrorist group that shifted their focus from a number of other circumstances that took place that, you know, just irrelevant details other than saying there was things that happened during the incident that probably precipitated a shift in the terrorist demands and wants during the negotiation process. And they shifted to that political objective or need. And when it shifts from the monetary to the political interest, or it blends with the political interest, that has catastrophic consequences to it, because that political one means most of the time that they're going to be looking at doing something horrific to get the world's attention. And that means executing people in many of these cases. And, you know, that was their own organizational kind of shift, think, and evolution of their group. And we just didn't have that visibility on it. And the timing of it was horrific bad luck on our part that they were shifting that way as an organization. We just didn't see it in time.
Yeah. For the listeners listening in on this, I really want you to internalize the lessons that Cal is giving off here, because, I mean, you will not get better lessons than this on how negotiations could potentially be different, or potentially it doesn't matter what you could have done. There's nothing that could have changed about that event. I really want you to internalize that, because there's a lot of false information that gets spread around about, you know, say these three things and the person will respond that way. And while that may be true some of the time, it's not true all of the time. And I really want to speak against that kind of teaching, because there are some things that might just end up happening that are just shitty and they're just bad luck. So I really want you to internalize that. Okay. Let's move on to the next negotiation. What was a negotiation that went really, really well? And what did you learn from that?
Well, what's interesting, with all my training and all my experience, probably the one, and maybe a very emotional one for myself, and probably said it went well because it was kind of one of those ones where all odds were against myself in this one. And the outcome was such a positive outcome. That's why I kind of have picked this one, but I think there's some good lessons into it. And what's funny is we haven't talked about this one, but let me just give you the situation first and then give you a point. I want to go back to a point that you mentioned earlier. So it takes place in 1993, 1994. I was deployed with the United Nations as a peacekeeper, and I probably shift that term to peacemaker because it was full-fledged warfare in the former Yugoslavia at the time. And coincidentally, I got involved just by fluke, actually, in some very complex, sensitive, volatile negotiations after somebody was kidnapped. And those negotiations were something referred to exchange commission negotiations. And those are the bodies within governments of the warring parties focused at doing negotiations on prisoner of war exchanges, body exchanges, and those are like dead bodies, people that were killed during the war, and returning them back to their families on the other side and to the other warring parties, and kidnappings. And they were all tied in that and the excavations of mass graves and returning the bodies to the other side and that. So it was a fairly kind of, the context was very dark, volatile, complex, huge emotion, huge history, culture, and all these other dynamics in it. The negotiations went on for 5 months. And started with the negotiations over several individuals that were kidnapped. But at the end of it, in the negotiation process, there was the successful release of dozens to 100. I don't know the exact number at the end of the day, how many were exchanged and that, but I would say upwards to 100, 200 people released from POW camps that were originally, some of them thought to be dead and then were found out to be alive. So this is the case that I thought had some great lessons for possibly your listeners. And the first point that I made in my notes today was exactly that point that you made. And I throw this one out. These are lessons in terms of reflective analysis that I thought were really key. But before I wrote these points down, I didn't know what the exact reasons the success occurred. And it goes back to your point of the luck. Was it some lucky timing that took place? So in my notes, I said, was the situation ripe as it related to timing? Because sometimes when you're doing negotiations or dealing with conflict situations, it has to be ripe. The parties have to be ready to do it.
Yes.
So did I walk in and just were at the right time and the deal was ready to be made? And I was just a little influence and the little mechanism that they were all looking for to resolve? Or was it something that I did? And I think that's something that a lot of negotiators that teach, and I've been in some think tanks with some of these, I think sometimes there's a tendency for people that are teaching to overemphasize the importance of thyself in the negotiation process without looking at, you know, a whole number of things, you know, that we've talked about before, structure, process, and everything else. But also what you pointed out, you used the word luck. I use the word timing in these particular circumstances. So I just highlight that before I get into it. So when I look at what was done right in this particular case, I think there was, for somebody that didn't have a lot of training in it, I was hyper-focused on analysis through this. And it wasn't something that was done, you know, because I was smarter than somebody else and had it all figured out at the beginning. But it was such a heart-wrenching experience that I was kept thinking about it. Plus, I was, you know, scared, nervous, because we were dealing with some very dangerous, concerning people in the middle of a war. So my brain was going pretty close 24/7 doing my analysis, talking to people. So I was doing it self-reflective, but I was talking to other people there. And I think that helped kind of define path opportunities and, equally important, risk and pitfalls during the negotiation process. That was something that was, you know, I think very, very helpful, which also led to the introduction. And I remember hearing Herb Cohen on once say, I know he's a guest and he's got to be one of the favorite guests that you've had.
Love him.
I like that guy. He kind of reminds me, like, that's who I aspire to think like and be like. And he referred once to the power of indifference. And during this negotiation process, as I was, for lack of a better term, trying to fix everything for everybody, I found that it was almost counterproductive in many regards, because then the parties began relying on me to fix, solve the problems and come up with a solution always. And I did that for about a month as I was going, you know, whatever, 16 hours a day trying to, you know, in this negotiation. Like, it was one of these negotiations that went on for 4 months, you know, and it was like 7 days a week, 16 hours a day of negotiations in terms of shuttle diplomacy and that, going back and forth, trying to find the deal in the case. But it wasn't until I was sitting down with one party. And again, it wasn't something that I had heard from Herb Cohen at the time. I wish I had before, because I probably would have saved myself 2 months in the negotiation process and not made some mistakes throughout. But it just came to me in the sitting at the table, and I was sitting across the table from this fellow, and he was in charge of it for the Croatian government. And he was my counterpart on the Croatian government side. And his name was Ivan Gruic. He said to me, he said, well, how can I help you in this negotiation process? And there wasn't a plan for this. It just came out instantaneously. I kind of surprised myself that I actually said it, because he's a fairly high ranking government official, you know, at a general level in the war. And I said, well, there's nothing you can help me with. I said, I'm actually here to help you, and you tell me how I can help you solve this problem. And I'm here to do anything you want me to do to solve it. And I kind of put myself in terms of a facilitator, supportive role, going, hey, whatever your interests are, whatever I can help you with, I'm here to kind of like do this for you versus, hey, I'm doing it for me. And there was an automatic shift in the negotiation process where the light went on, and I had set the stage at the table. And it's something that Cialdini later introduced me to, who we are both fans of in terms of social persuasion. And he introduced me to something that's not in his book, I don't think, but it was called the concept of mining the environment. And that's a concept where, instead of you applying social influence and persuasion on other parties, that you go to a third party and have that third party that has some stronger relationship already existing with that person. And the message goes from, you know, you as a negotiator to the third party to the target, i.e. the other party that you're negotiating with. And it wasn't something that was designed that way, but it's something that was just coincidentally happened. And then when I talked to Cialdini, I thought, hey, this was probably like, you know, 15 years later. That's why this work was that whole mining the environment tactic. So that whole power of indifference, I think, was a game changer in that negotiation, as it was a turning point in it. And that was the third point that came up that learned from this one. Was, you know, we all talk about, you know, analysis, the importance of, you know, defining the interest, understanding, you know, the culture, the context, and all. So I use the term intel-led negotiations on that, you know, because I come from the police military type background. So I'll go, hey, introduce the term intel-led negotiations based on information and analysis. But I learned in this particular one that I didn't have all the intel that I needed, but what compensated, I think, for any gaps in that was a balance and the blend of intel with principles. And we've talked about this before, where I was honest, I was compassionate, I was empathetic, I was very concerned and caring about the outcome on it. And I just used my kind of who I was as a person, you know, from, hey, what did I learn from my parents? in terms of being a good person. And I infuse that with being smart and intelligent. When I reflect back, why was I successful? It was a blend of intel / principle led negotiations and that. So when I didn't know everything, I just relied and fell back to my principles. And I think that kind of carried me throughout, helped me develop trust with the other parties and a rapport with the other parties. And I think that led to a positive outcome in this particular case.
I love that. And one of the things, we had Gary Mesner on a while back, and he always speaks about the power of life experience and the power of that comes with being a negotiator. And I think that really speaks to what you're saying, because you get that ability to empathize and be there in that environment, and you get those principles based on your life experience. And I think that speaks volumes for what you've done and for what you've been through. A couple of the things that I picked up on during this discussion that I really want the listeners to pay attention to. Listeners, one thing that Cal mentioned that I think is critical is the importance of planning and strategy. And if you listen to the previous interview that we did with him, he calls it his 3S approach. And this is really, really important. He spoke about, you know, if for 30 minutes of discussion, they were doing like 30 hours of planning. That's real, right? Like, I mean, I think in the business world, in terms of resources, we probably kind of apply that. But I think it's important to recognize that there's a significant amount of analytics and planning that go into any negotiation. My rule of thumb is 5X. Like, if you're going to be on the phone for a half an hour, you're going to be doing 2.5 hours of planning and strategy to be involved in that negotiation, in that discussion. If you're going to be on the phone for an hour, you're going to have 5 hours of planning and strategy that go into that discussion. So I think one of the things that I really want people to take away from this is the real, real importance that goes into planning and strategy so that you can come out of this with the right plan and right objectives. The other thing that I think is really important to understand is there's a number of things that are outside of your control. And I know that I kind of was a little bit hard on some of the hardcore tacticians out there that really, really just focus on tactics. And maybe that was a little bit unfair, but there's probabilistic thinking that has to go into this. Yes, you've got to have the tactics. Obviously, you've got to know the words to say and the body language and all that kind of stuff. I'm not trying to minimize that. And I also think that the critical components there is to understand that even if you do that stuff, there are some cases where it's not going to be in your favor. So yes, you're going to improve the probability of success by having the right words and all that kind of stuff, but know that sometimes things just don't go your way. And when things don't go your way, that's when you really have to pull from the depth of your character and pull from your principles, like Cal said, to get through that negotiation. Cal, I've really enjoyed this discussion. How can people find you online?
Could I seize one quick opportunity for one lesson that I think applies to both the good and the bad? And that is the importance of, I think, taking risks in negotiations. And in both those cases, you know, in terms of the failure, in terms of the success, taking risk, I think, was key and critical, or the absence of, I think, sometimes results in negative outcomes. So I just thought that was, I had that in my notes for today, and I just wanted to include that. And one little piece of advice for the negotiators, and I share this a couple days before I get to go visit my aging father, and that's an advice that he gave me. And I share this with negotiators that are going through this professionally that had some failures, as I've had many, both professionally and personally. Is my father always said to me, Mark, that success never comes from climbing the highest and steepest peaks, but from surviving the lowest and darkest valleys in life. And I think that has a lot of applicability to the negotiation process. And when I look at my successes and my failures in all of this, it was really surviving and plowing through, for lack of a better term, those challenges. And I just like to reinforce what you said too, is the tactics are super important for sure. But I think what both of us just want to do is just to highlight the complexity of this profession and, you know, some of the risk of oversimplifying it sometimes, just in support to help, you know, the professionals be successful in their future and that. But to get a hold of me through LinkedIn, I can get reached at. I alluded to you last time that we're starting to move a lot into the cyber area as well, which is something.
Yeah, we got to have you back on to talk about that, man. It sounds super interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of something I didn't expect to fall into, because I'm still at that shift F7 delete thinking in terms of my technical capability. But it's kind of shocking and surprising to see the congruent interest in terms of from kidnapping negotiations to cyber ones. So we can talk about that one day. But LinkedIn's probably the best way to connect with me.
Amazing. Listeners, I'll be connecting to all of Cal's profiles online and ways to connect with him online in the show notes. Cal, again, thank you so much for being on the show, man. It's always such a great privilege. I really, really appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark. Really enjoyed the chat today, and I appreciate the opportunity of being here the second time. I kind of feel somewhat honored, so thank you very much.
Hey friends, thanks so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed it, please share it with friends and colleagues so that they can benefit from it as well. If you find Negotiations Ninja Podcast worthy, please go onto iTunes and give us a cool rating with a nice review. We certainly appreciate every single one that we get because it helps us to understand who is listening, how they're listening, and what it is they like. If there's something that you would like me to discuss around negotiation, influence, or persuasion, give me a shout. You know how to reach me on social media, or you can get me on my website, which is www.negotiations.ninja.